Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
In Title I, the commodities program, so PLC, the price loss coverage program, that's our fixed price program. We got a price set in statute. We'll talk about this one a little bit more as we go.
Ag policy expert Jonathan Kappas.
The agriculture risk coverage at the county level and at the individual levels are also built into this. And you can see, again, the expectations back in May was for pretty low spending here in the near term with higher, stronger prices. I expect that to probably even be more pronounced at a low level, given where we think prices are going to be in the next few years. But we are looking out over 10 years, and so CBO is typically going to expect that these programs spend and that those prices readjust down closer to the reference prices in PLC in particular in the out years.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The dairy industry is a very large industry and very important to the U.S. economy.
Austin Gelling with the Association of Equipment Manufacturers.
As of 2021, the dairy industry contributes about 3.5% to total U.S. GDP. For comparison's sake, you know, an industry that, at least when I think of it, is very large, the auto industry, only contributes about 2.7% to total U.S. GDP. So the dairy industry is a very large contributing factor to that, contributing over 3.3 million jobs and $42 billion in direct wages. And as I mentioned, you know, by 2050, the industry is committed to being net neutral in terms of environmental impact. And one of the other things that we wanted to touch on in this study as well, you can't talk about dairy or animal agriculture without also getting into the animal welfare side of things. And 99% of all U.S. milk comes from farmers taking part in the farm program, which is farmers assuring responsible management, really to ensure things like proper animal care, and then even getting to into things that address some other concerns like environmental impact, responsible antibiotic use, biosecurity, and so on.
He's talking about a new study in association with the Dairy Farmers of America and National Milk Producers Federation.
To dispel some of the myths about the dairy industry, talking about things like, you know, milk alternatives being healthier, and talking about, you know, cow comfort, antibiotic use, and so on. And so we really wanted to provide some information to dispel those myths and really tell our side of the story when it comes to that information. And then we also wanted to just talk about the good things that the dairy industry has done. What's the benefit to the industry, to the end of product, and really, you know, put a positive spin on what we're doing as dairy farmers and the product that we're producing and putting out there.
The study looking at the environmental benefits of modern dairy technologies.
This is just a high-level overview. So as of 2007, so over the last 15 years, we've gotten so much more efficient producing milk that if we were to produce at 2007 levels today, we could do so with 930,000 less cows. Now, obviously, we don't have that many less cows because we're producing more milk to feed a growing population. We've also been able to reduce the feed usage by the equivalent of 3,200 NFL football stadiums full of feed. Now, I struggle, you know, you think we're here in California, so you've got the 49ers stadium, and you go down to L.A., and you got SoFi Stadium. Thinking of one of those stadiums full of cattle feed blows my mind. 3,200 of those, that's kind of hard to wrap your head around a little bit. Kind of then playing off of, you know, the reduced feed, better feed utilization. We've also reduced our need for land by the equivalent of the size of Maryland. So that's land that we haven't had to put into feed production to grow feed just as a result of that. We've also been able to reduce our emissions by the equivalent of taking 4 million cars off the road permanently, which that's equivalent to about 2 to 3% of all cars driven in the U.S. annually. So we no longer produce those emissions. And then lastly, we've been able to save the equivalent of enough water to supply New York City with water for 2 years. And that's mainly looking at, you know, from the feed production side to in-barn use. That's not even getting into things like then water usage when it comes to manure application, liquid manure application, and so on. And, you know, when you talk about anything like this, when you talk about technology, you have to also acknowledge there are enablers to these technologies that help us see these gains. So deeper insights. Data is key to a lot of this. And data, also, when you talk about things like genetics, so a lot of this technology, constantly collecting data about the cow, about our operations, and even to be able to unlock things like the full genetic potential of the cow, the data insights that this machinery collects and that then is used is key to doing so.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Of course, we have diverse agriculture in Tennessee, but the Central Valley, I think, presents an amazing array of products and diversity in terms of the ag production in this valley.
Representative John Rose is a member of the House Ag Committee from Tennessee, attending World Ag Expo.
I think, you know, farmers face enough uncertainty with the weather, the marketplace, the challenges that they get in those arenas. We need to try to provide as much stability from the policy side as we can. They don't need surprises from Washington or from state capitals, so we need to work to give them a level playing field and a runway that they can work through and produce the food that the American people and the world needs.
Rose, one of the members attending a listening session at World Ag Expo. Aubrey Betancourt is CEO of the Almond Alliance.
This is the Coachella of farming. This is the festival of festivals when it comes to farming and agriculture in the world. There is, I forget how many countries come in, dozens and dozens of countries, multiple states. This is the true collective of, maybe it's more like a South by Southwest, because this is the meeting of technology, of entertainment, of food, of innovation from all over the world in the business of feeding and sustaining our growing world right here in Tulare, California every year.
And who is the Almond Alliance?
The Almond Alliance is the American Trade Association for American Almonds. Almond farmers in the United States produce 80% of the world's supply of almonds. We have a monopoly on the world. We're on 11 of 14 grocery aisles now. We have 7,600 farms, 90% of them family-owned and operated, 75% of them less than 100 acres, and we're producing 80% of the world's supply of almonds.
Trade has been a really big deal for a big export item, almonds.
The supply chain is clunky, but it's moving. We've got these new avenues. We're going to keep pushing product. But the trick now is selling that product. So trade is top of the scroll now. Part of that functioning supply chain is having a functioning market. And so we look at, you know, everything from the retaliatory tariffs. This is something that we've seen come up. It still is continuing to drive. I don't have a problem with protecting American jobs. I have a problem with protecting American jobs at the expense of other American jobs. And that's kind of the dynamic we're in there. So that's in that category. Then we have our non-tariff barriers. These are some of the MRL rules and the irregularities across Europe that are dictating to us and constantly changing in the rules how we need to grow our product, package our product, trade our product, get it overseas. We need some consistency in that space. These are, I think, some opportunities that we want to see addressed in the current Congress with this administration. So again, if you don't want to deal with retaliatory tariffs, fine, I get it. Let's deal with some things that we can control. And the last one is let's open new markets. We actually have a great new developing market out there, I think, in a lot of parts of the world, that if we created some trade advantages, we'd really do some great good of getting our growing product to a growing world that is demanding our product. Almonds don't have a demand problem. We have a market and a shipping problem right now. We have people that want to buy our product. We just need, I think, a little more grease to get them out and get them to them. And there's this great new population that I think is going to really appreciate the product and the diversity of the product that we have as this high, stable protein that we can keep and deliver any time of year.
Wait, trade and almonds? They're a big deal?
We think almonds are pretty darn cool, not just because it's what we do and what we grow, but we are one of the largest exports for ag in the United States. Actually, we're in the top four. And so when we talk about, you know, needing to get back out in the world, that's about getting America back out in the world. And so we want to partner with all our friends in ag all across the country and continue to do that.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So how is it that we're spending, you know, these large, expected to spend these large sums in, 26, 27 and beyond?
Jonathan Kappas, former administrator with the Farm Service Agency, is an ag policy expert, University of Illinois.
And a lot of it is due to how the price loss coverage program works. And that is Congress sets a fixed price. Let's take wheat, for example. Wheat's reference price is $5.50. If during the course of the 12-month marketing year following wheat harvest, the national average price received by farmers is below that $5.50, we trigger payments. And so when CBO does their calculations, they estimate, you know, they forecast, they use USDA forecasts and others to try to get an estimate of where prices are going to be over this long, long 10-year window. And here you can see in particular wheat expected to be below its reference price in the out years, so 26 and beyond. And that's triggering a large amount of those payments. Soybeans, by comparison, is expected to stay well above its reference price of $8.40 and likely not to trigger any payments. Corn's a little bit closer to that reference price, so it's feeding some expectations of spending there, but not a lot. By comparison, looking at our other three major crops and major both in terms of acreage, but also in terms of the political influence, if you will, or political footprint in these discussions, if we look at our southern crops, cotton, rice, and peanuts, we can see quite a bit of difference in the way the PLC program operates for these crops. So all three of them are expected to be below their reference prices in the out years. Now, again, this is likely to adjust when CBO re-forecasts. But peanuts, I think, is probably the one that jumps out the most. And it was projected in May to be well below its reference price. So the expectations in this program would be payments every year and large payments for peanuts, which if we take the expected outlays that CBO projected back in May and we divide it by the number of base acres that are in the program, this is what it looks like year over year, crop by crop. The main takeaway here is the importance of where that reference price is set. It's also a reminder of this baseline challenge because rice and peanuts are the smallest crops in the program. So if you increase their reference price, you can spend a lot more money per acre on those crops and those farmers who have base acres of those crops. But it doesn't show up in the baseline the same way. And this is, you know, a bit of a challenge for crops like corn and soybeans. Soybeans in particular, if we go back up here a minute, if soybeans want to move that reference price closer to where the forecasted prices are going to be, we're talking 50, 60 million acres potentially expected in that program, which is going to spend a lot more money in the baseline and be extraordinarily costly over a 10-year window. And so it challenges these larger crops under this baseline sort of zero-sum game that they cannot as easily increase the trigger points for program payments because they're paying out on such large acreage. And large acreage with payments over 10 years is extraordinarily expensive in the baseline. So this is, if you will, this is sort of a rough perspective around some of the politics at the committee level in particular, around how these programs are created, how we negotiate things like the fixed reference price in the statute, kind of who wins and loses in that undertaking. And certainly, you know, these politics break out on the regional lines because the southern crops are getting these larger payments every year. And, you know, their membership is more likely wanting to protect that or improve that. And so these are some of the indicators of the political challenges that we'll see at the committee level in particular. A lot of this won't get worked out on a floor debate because it's pretty deep in the weeds of the policy, but it certainly is something that the committees will work a lot on.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
This is all about getting our dairy farmers in the United States a fair deal, making sure that they get the market access that they were promised.
Chief Ag Negotiator with U.S. Trade Representative's Office, Doug McCallum.
Under the USMCA, the government of Canada made commitments to our U.S. dairy farmers that they would have entry for their products into the Canadian market. However, really what the ensuing couple of years showed was that the Canadian government did not provide the access that our producers felt would be fair and equitable. So in December of 2021, the United States brought forward and we won a USMCA case over Canada's policies and their dairy tariff rate quotas. However, Canada's implementation, once the U.S. won that case, still didn't provide the market access our farmers deserved. Essentially, they locked out importers that were actual retailers and actual sizable importers. So what we have done, the United States Trade Representative, has launched a second dispute panel request so that we can have a case in front of the Canada government that will lock them into the kind of market access that our dairy farmers deserve and expect.
But moving from one trade agreement to another,
the United States and the United Kingdom continue to explore the path towards a trade agreement, though there are still several obstacles that need to be addressed. Dave Salmonson, American Farm Bureau Federation Senior Government Affairs Director, explains.
Both the countries are engaging in something called dialogues, where they are exploring issues, trying to get better relationships. The U.S. and U.K. in agriculture have a pretty robust trade. Each country sends about $2 billion worth annually to the other, but it certainly is something that definitely can be improved.
The United Kingdom's Secretary of Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs called for a free trade agreement with the U.S. this week in Washington.
Farm Bureau certainly supports that. There's several barriers. The United Kingdom is still moving away from their time as being part of the European Union. Their regulatory system needs a push. They need to move closer to a science tariff-based standard system that we have. They need to reduce their tariffs. They've signed trade agreements this past year with both Australia and New Zealand, where they're phasing out tariffs on food imports, and we need the same treatment.
Meanwhile, Mexico issued a new decree regarding importing genetically modified corn.
They want to phase out fairly quickly the imports of white corn from the U.S. and look to some point next year or beyond to phase down imports of yellow corn. None of this has any basis in science, so this is giving more impetus to the folks urging our trade representative's office just to bring a case under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement against Mexico. Certainly, we think this is a very clear trade violation of that agreement.
USDA's February farm income report shows net farm income, a broad measure of farm profitability, is currently forecast at $137 billion in 2023. American Farm Bureau Federation economist Danny Munch says that represents a $26 billion decline from last year.
And that $26 billion decline erases the $22 billion gain that farmers were expected to receive between 2021 and 2022. So a big drop from last year, but we're still above the prior 10-year average, which is a good thing.
Part of the decline in net farm income stems from increasing input costs.
The report expects farm and ranch production expenses to continue to increase by $18.2 billion, or 4%, over last year. That's already on top of a $70 billion increase from last year. Much of those increases are linked to marketing and transportation expenses, interest expenses, which are going to increase as the Fed attempts to fight inflation, and labor costs, which are increasing across the board.
Munch says farm sector debt is expected to increase to a record $535 billion as well.
Most of that tied up in the form of real estate debt, mainly because farm real estate continues to increase in value. This really just means that the value of assets regularly being purchased with debt is rising. So it'll be increasingly important for farmers and ranchers to pay down debt and maintain that healthy balance sheet. And that's going to be ever more cumbersome as interest rates increase well into the next few years.
Michael Klimitz, Washington.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're looking at climate neutrality in beef and dairy. Climate neutrality is that point where we are no longer adding warming to the climate.
Joe Proudman is Associate Director of Communications at the Clear Center at UC Davis, speaking recently at World Ag Expo.
It's significant for our sector because at the end of the day, methane is our Achilles heel, right? Methane is a strong, potent gas that has a very, very short lifespan, much different than carbon dioxide. In fact, they're almost complete opposites, right? Not as powerful. Methane is 28 more times powerful, but has a much longer lifespan. All the carbon dioxide that we emit today will be here for generations, thousands of years. Because of that, though, and you hear this a lot, methane is our quickest tool to reduce emissions, to reduce temperatures, or to slow climate change, is because it is that short lifespan that does it. And we get to that point, if we have constant emissions, say you don't grow your herd size, we will not be adding additional warming to the atmosphere. It's a very, very rudimentary explanation of it. But generally, that's what we're talking about. The key is, though, if you reduce it, then we have really good things. Only two sectors can pull carbon out of the atmosphere. That is agriculture and forestry. So the opportunity that we have to do that is immense, and to be part of a climate solution. So we really do talk about climate neutrality. When somebody talks about carbon neutrality, they're essentially talking about the same thing, right? If your primary greenhouse gas you emit is carbon dioxide, you get to zero emissions or you balance that out, you're at climate neutrality. So it's analogous. We talk a lot about dairy digesters. I'm going to show you a research paper we just did around that. We look at feed additives. In those bubbles, we'll often look at additives. So like say we're feeding them maybe like agolin or something like that, you know, where we're seeing how much methane they can reduce. I mentioned we had protein intake. We did a recent trial with Cargill on that. And then we're looking at how we measure methane emissions. Right now, you know, GWP 100 is kind of the standard. It'll continue to be the standard, but it doesn't always account for methane's short lifespan and the consequences of that. So we talk a lot about GWP star, which is just another matrix, another way to measure how methane emissions are impacting our climate. This white paper was written, we called it the Three Amigos paper because it was written with Dr. Frank Mittlener, Dr. Hermes Cabreab, and Dr. Daniel Sumner. These were three of the leading scientists in this field. Frank and Hermes looking at how we're reducing emissions in animals, and Dan looking at the economics around agriculture and livestock. We presented this paper to the California Resources Board, the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the CDFA, and also the California EPA the other day, just to talk about, hey, what we're doing in the dairy sector, the emissions we're reducing, and how we're doing it, it's working. And we will meet state goals by 2030 if we continue to aggressively mitigate and incentivize these mitigations. And of course, right now I'm talking about digesters, right, on the dairy side. Digesters have been an immensely powerful tool for us at the end of the day to reduce emissions. Farmers have an income, but we've also reduced 30% of our goal so far. One thing we know is that that goal, that number, that 30%, it doesn't account for all the digesters we have. We're probably much, much further along there. And we further talk about the need to tackle enteric emissions and how if we really still want to reduce emissions, incentivizing those will be beneficial. The California climate investments that the state has invested in, they've invested only 2% of those dollars into digesters and alternative manure management programs, but those have reduced 30% of the emissions in that program. By far, the most effective use of funds in that program so far. So we do. We try to be the conveners, you know, between academics, the industry, regulators, and whoever else, and consumers as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
What is critical about this, as anybody that's dealt with recent farm bills knows, the baseline is the budget the committees have to work with. And under budget rules, they are required to stay within this baseline.
Jonathan Kappas is a former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency, now is an ag policy expert. University of Illinois talking about why raising revenues is not an option.
And so any changes to statute will be scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and those changes have to be offset. So that means you have to cut other programs to offset increased spending. It used to mean you could raise revenue if you needed to. The House has implemented new rules this year, this Congress, that would require cuts, so you cannot increase revenues in any way, shape, or form. So this really creates a zero-sum political game under the baseline. What happens if you want to spend more money on Title I payments? Well, under the rules, you're going to have to cut something else. You're going to have to cut within the jurisdiction of the committee, and that means you're going to have to likely look at either SNAP, crop insurance, or conservation as a source of offsets. And of course, the politics of that are, well, rather challenging.
So why is the 2018 Farm Bill so unique? Kappas explains.
The 2018 Farm Bill has nearly run out its five-year life, but this Farm Bill's existence has been rather unusual in terms of Farm Bill history and expectations. This chart before you is a comparison of what was spent, 2022 forecast to be spent, under the farm programs, that's the Navy bars, and then the supplemental and ad hoc programs that have kicked in since 2018 with the market facilitation program in 18 and 19, and then, of course, the coronavirus response programs and payments in 2020 and 2021 and into 2022. And so this is unusual for multiple reasons. It is rare to, in fact, it's never happened that we've seen this level of ad hoc spending on farmers in addition to farm program payments. It is unusual for there to be multiple years of this. Typically, we'd see an ad hoc, you know, in response to a drought or hurricane scenario. But to go through multiple programs over multiple years created using largely using the existing authorities and the Commodity Credit Corporation, it's pretty unusual to see that kind of year-over-year aspect. So almost the entire life of this farm bill has been shadowed by this ad hoc and supplemental spending. And then, you know, the other side is it's just unusual for there to be that much more spending through an ad hoc system than the authorized programs. What does this mean for a 2023 farm bill debate? I think is one of the big questions we have before us and the committees have before them in this discussion. For one thing, it is certainly challenging perspectives around what spending goes out to farmers and how the programs work and look to them. Particularly under the coronavirus assistance programs, we provided assistance to a much larger population of farmers, a much larger set of crops, fruit and vegetable crops, livestock, who don't typically get Title I program payments. How does that impact their decisions and their requests in a farm bill? And how does that play out given the baseline limitations we have? So I think this is kind of one of those, as we look at our roadmaps, this is going to be one of those challenging areas on the path, sorting this out and helping particularly some of the farmers and crops who don't typically get assistance but have seen it in recent years leading into this farm bill. This is something we'll be watching and looking to discuss as we go.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Our nation has requested a second dispute settlement panel within the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement associated with Canada's dairy tariff rate quotas. Yet how might this process work? An explanation is provided by U.S. Trade Representative's Office Chief Agricultural Negotiator Doug McCaleb.
We bring the case, our findings, and our documentation to the panel. The way these things operate, we would expect to have a response and a finding from the panel in 2023, so that will take place within this calendar year. And we're really focused on this case that's in front of us. We think that we have got very clear and solid backing for it. We think our dairy farmers are in a very solid position.
It was December 2021 that a similar USMCA dispute settlement panel ruled in favor of the U.S. in its claims that Canadian dairy TRQs hindered market access to our nation's dairy products under that agreement. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.